text 19. 18 was very much centered on that the Lord was the center of yoga. 19. Apparently, I'll read it first and then we'll go over it a little more carefully and then read the parts of the purport. Apparently entering among the variegated species of living beings you have created, you inspire them to act, manifesting yourself according to their higher and lower positions, just as fire manifests differently according to the shape of what it burns. Therefore, those of spotless intelligence, who are altogether freed from material attachments, realize your undifferentiated, unchanging self to be the permanent reality among all these impermanent life forms. That's two sentences, by the way. So apparently entering among the variegated species of living beings you have created. So many concepts are in that. First is that all the living beings are created or come from him. And because and there's so many different species, so it's not talking about the souls, but the different species of living beings, such as the birds and tigers, etc. But he apparently enters them. That means he doesn't in fact enter within them and become one with them or become part of them. It's an apparent entry because he always remains in the spiritual energy. Sambhavam yatma mayaya. He's always in the spiritual energy and never enters into the same realm of material energy as the living beings enter into. The different species of life. So he inspires them to act, and that is from the position of the supersoul. So that's basically what this verse is glorifying, the supersoul as the inspiration to act within every living being. And he manifests yourself according to their higher and lower positions, just as fire manifests differently according to the shape of what it burns. But fire is one and the super soul is one. Even though it may be manifested, appear to the inspiration, it appears to be coming from a tiger or a peacock or an amoeba or a fly. So again, pointing to the oneness of the inspirer, the foundation, the foundational principle of in all actions. And therefore, those of spotless intelligence, those who see things properly, uninfluenced by the modes of material nature, because it's the modes of material nature that cover and cause imperfections in our intelligence. Therefore, those of spotless intelligence who are altogether free from material attachments, so the two go together, pure, clear intelligence and freedom from material attachments. Why? Because the contaminations on the intelligence cause, and remember these are Shruti type of verses, so the main thing is everything is proceeding from the intelligence. And this is actually one of the symptoms of old cultures as opposed to modern cultures. In old cultures, it was really seen that if you had knowledge, then automatically knowledge of what is right and what is wrong, then you would do what is right. If you knew the difference between right and wrong, you'd just simply do what is right because it's the right thing to do. But in contemporary so-called civilization, this knowledge is truly insufficient because of the increase in the lower modes of material nature and the decrease in the sense of dutifulness, which is born of the mode of goodness. So people often know what is right, and that's more or less irrelevant to what they do, because what's important is what I want to do. So that means due to the mode of passion and the mode of ignorance, the false ego is the undisputed reigning king, sovereign over a person and what he wants. The mind becomes stronger, the intelligence less important, and the important thing becomes to desire, to want, as opposed to do, to act according to what is correct, according to the intelligence. So it's actually a known specific difference between old culture and new cultures, this particular point. So in any case, therefore, with those with spotless intelligence who clearly see, that means uncontaminated intelligence, uncovered intelligence, uncontaminated by the modes, who are altogether free from material attachments, which basically means that their intelligence is situated in goodness, they realize your undifferentiated, unchanging self to be the permanent reality among all these impermanent life forms. So there are so many life forms, 8,400,000, and then there is the soul who is identifying with them, and then the super soul who inspires them to act savasya tam with the son of wisdom, matya smitam gyanam aponam. It inspires them to act, picking up their impressions and desires from previous lives. At the right time, the light goes on in the consciousness, and I want this, I want that. So, amongst all the different forms of life, and this is true also for like in the animal level too, you see this with there's that silly little dog who runs around the MBT all the time, and the dog identifies with being a, anyone watch the dog? No one's a dog observer of this dog ever. The dog thinks he's a monkey, basically, because he grew up with monkeys. So what causes a dog to think he's a monkey? This is something from a previous life. And the monkeys come over to him, and the reason they say they keep the dog there is to keep the monkeys away. But the monkeys, they'll be sitting there, and the monkeys will walk over to him. Little ones, they'll go like, slap him in the face, like this. And then he doesn't get angry at them. He goes and smells them a little bit. And then he doesn't get angry at them. Every once in a while, he chases them a little bit, and they run away about this much above him on a tree or something like that. In a few minutes, he just sits down, they sit down. Because he grew up with monkeys, he doesn't know who he is. He doesn't know he's a great, powerful, ferocious dog. He thinks he's a monkey. And it's actually quite funny to watch them dealing, because he'll sort of smells their fur, and he likes the smell of monkey fur, which is quite amazing if you think about it. And then they go over to him and they slap him in the face, and they play with him, try to agitate him a little bit. And they just sit there, eat together and everything. So he has something, because most of the dogs are like this. He's carrying something from his previous life. Maybe he was, who knows, but maybe he was killed by a dog, and he was thinking about a dog in his last life. He's a monkey killed by a dog, who knows? So at a certain time, these inclinations and are inspired by the Lord from within the heart due to one's previous sanskaras, even in animal bodies or bird bodies or fly bodies. I have noticed that some flies are very aggressive and some are more peaceful and some attack you. Have you noticed that? You haven't noticed it? Have you noticed that? Some of them go, they get stuck inside your room and they attack you even though they're so little. So within each of them, each of the species of life appearing to be the life of that species, the same Lord is there. He's the permanent reality amongst the impermanent life forms. Because the life forms are always changing, but the principle of the super soul within the heart inspiring the actions of all souls is consistent. So we've touched this point already. So this is an Upanishadic point. So despite with being in the hearts, with that you are there, O Lord. You are the super soul in the hearts of all living entities. You remain constant despite traveling with the living entities, the souls as they change their bodies from one species to another. So we'll start reading at the beginning of the purport. Hearing these prayers of the personified Vedas, in which the Shrutis describe the super soul as entering countless varieties of material bodies, a critic may question how the Supreme can do this without becoming limited. Indeed, proponents of Advaita philosophy see no essential distinction between the Supreme Soul and his creation. In the impersonalist conception, the Absolute has inexplicably gotten itself trapped by illusion. In other words, somehow or another, he's gotten himself, the Absolute Truth, the Supreme Lord, has gotten himself trapped by illusion and has thus become first the personal God and then the demigods, humans, animals, plants, and finally matter. So when Mayavad philosophy is that there is one soul and somehow or another, that one soul becomes covered by the mode of goodness, and it becomes Ishvara, and it becomes covered by other modes, and it becomes the Jiva. Shankaracharya and his followers take great pains to cite Vedic evidence to support this theory of how illusion is imposed on the Absolute. So the question, of course, that we always ask, how is it that the Supreme becomes overpowered by Maya or illusion that forces him into become a jiva? The impersonalists, of course, they can't say that a force is higher than the Absolute Brahman, because there can't be anything outside of the Brahman by definition. So they can't say it's more powerful, because that would enforces the Brahman to become jiva, because that would implicitly say that there's something, a dualistic system. So they say the same Brahman self-deludes himself, basically. But there's a problem with that, because if he has the desire to self-delude himself, then there's already duality, there's him and his desire. So there's problems with this. So therefore, they take great pains to cite Vedic evidence to support the theory of how illusion is imposed on the Absolute. But speaking for themselves, the Vedas here answer this objection and refuse to lend authority to the Mayavada impersonalism. So I'll summarize some now. So what really happens is that all souls are eternal, and the Lord enters the body of every living entity as the super soul to provide guidance and inspiration for the soul. Although he enters, he possesses no false ego, and he has no attachment to Maya. So he's transcendental, he's beyond. So this isn't news for any of us, because we've studied the Bhagavad Gita, and we know the philosophy of Christian consciousness. He's not entangled, although he appears to be entering with the variegated, with the souls into the different species of life. The soul is in a very the tiny, insignificant jiva soul, jivatma, is in a different situation that he is in, because he is transcendental. And the soul, although transcendental due to him being tiny and insignificant, is overpowered by Maya. But he, being Vibhu, or the great powerful one, he cannot be overpowered by his own energy. So now we'll continue with the beginning of the first paragraph on page 634. Even in the midst of material creation and destruction, the Lord of all creatures remains eternally unchanged. So the species change, the soul moves from body to body, the body of the bird disintegrates, the body of the tiger disintegrates back into the elements of which it's composed. The soul also changes in the sense that he changes his body, but he doesn't really change, because he is an eternal part and parcel of Krishna. But the super soul doesn't change. He remains always the all-pervading, all-knowing witness who is the friend of all living entities, of the living entity. Yadva Santim Ritsiti. And knowing him as such, as the controller of everything, and as the friend of all living entities, and the one who all jagyas are meant to satisfy, one actually becomes peaceful, knowing that he's actually suited. And if he wasn't suited, the dear friend, why would he accompany the living entity? Why would he accompany the soul? The soul goes into abominable places with abominable consciousness. Not the soul goes into abominable places, but his consciousness becomes abominably perverted. And he stays with him, but he never adopts the contaminations of the material world, and still he stays with us. So, Shanti Mam Ritsiti, one becomes peaceful upon knowing that. Again, knowing it, it's not a matter of theoretical knowing it, it's a matter of truly knowing it on a deeper level, so that one can place his consciousness in that type of a mood, knowing that the super soul is my friend. Friend means he's truly interested in my welfare. And he's all-powerful. So what a wonderful combination. Someone all-powerful, truly interested in my welfare. Even in the midst of material creation and destruction, the Lord of all creatures remains eternally unchanged, as expressed here by the words Eka Rasam. In other words, the Lord eternally maintains his personal form of immeasurable, unalloyed spiritual pleasure. This is his constitutional position. The rare living beings who completely disengage themselves from material dealings, or panna, come to know the Supreme Lord as he is. Every intelligent person should follow the example of these great souls and beg from them the chance to also be engaged in the Supreme Lord's devotional service. So to know the Lord as he is within the heart means to engage in his service, means to not theoretically know, but to act on the principle of knowledge. But to act on the principle of knowledge. It's insufficient to know and then not act. This prayer is recited by Shrutis, whose mood is similar to that expressed in the following mantra of the Sweta Svatara Upanishad, again citing the Shruti Pramana, the Vedic Pramana, the Shabda Pramana, the Upanishadic proof that this is actually what the Shrutis are saying. It is not an imposed meaning upon the Shrutis, while the Shrutis are saying something vastly different. So therefore, our acharyas offer quotations from the Upanishads to show this indeed is what they're saying. It's not an imposition. So here's an example. Eko deva sabhabhuteshu gundha sarvavyapi sabhabhutataram tatmana ratma kama dhyaksa sabhabhutveshaha sakshi chaitakevalo nirgunascha. The one Supreme Lord lives hidden inside all created things. He pervades all matter because he's in everyone's heart, and he's in every atom, and he's between every atom. And he sits within the heart of all living beings. As the indwelling super soul, he supervises their material activities. Thus, while having no material qualities, he is the unique witness and giver of consciousness. So, sometimes it will say that he has no qualities, but the meaning is kevalo nirgunascha. He obviously has qualities because he has the quality of being with the living entity. He has the quality of supervising him. So it's obvious that he has qualities. So to say that he has, and it's also from other shastra, we know that he's the size of a thumb, so that's certainly a quality. So if we say that he is nirguna, it obviously means something other than him having no qualities whatsoever. So what it does mean, as we all very well know, is it means he has no material qualities. Like someone, we could say he's completely detached. Krishna is completely detached. He's full of renunciation. But we see that means that he's completely attached to his devotees as well. So Srila Sridhar Swami submits his own prayer in this regard. Swarnamiteshu kayeshu taratmya vijarjitam savanusyuto sanmatram bhagavantam bhajamahe. Let us worship the Supreme Lord who enters the products of his own creation yet remains aloof from their superior and inferior material gradations. So he creates, he enters. First canto of the Bhagavatam describes this. The Purusha enters. And, or Pumsam, as it describes there, or the Purusha enters, and then the Pumsam. Yet he enters, but he remains aloof. They have different gradations, higher and lower. And he has nothing to do with either higher or lower, even though he's within them, because he remains always the pure, undifferentiated existence pervading everything. And then verse 20. The individual living entity, while inhabiting the material bodies he has created for himself by his karma. Okay, so here we just talked about, there was a few verses talking about the super soul is glorified. And here, what about the living entity? The individual living entity, while inhabiting the material bodies he has created for himself by his karma, actually remains uncovered by either gross or subtle matter. So this is an interesting point. Prabhupada mentions it in the second canto of the Bhagavatam as well, how the soul never actually mixes with matter. There is something inconceivable that goes on. The connection between the spirit soul, who is one substance, spiritual energy, Chetragyakyatatapara, he is parashakti, he is spiritual energy, is influenced by a completely different substance, Krishna Shakti, Maya Prokta, of Krishna's Maya Shakti. So, how is this possible? We see with the example, simple examples, like water doesn't mix with oil. You put the two together and they don't mix. And air can be have dust within it, but the dust is the quality of the dust and the air is the quality of the air. It's not like the air, we say the air has dust in it, but the particle of air doesn't have any dust in it. The air doesn't have any dust in it. It's a solution. It doesn't truly dissolve. Or it's, what is that called?
It's soluble.
It's colloidal suspension. The particles are in suspension, but they don't actually. There's no mixing between them on any subtle level. But yet, so that's the examples. That's practically given with the soul and it's dealing with matter, but yet we experience ourselves not at all separate from matter. We experience ourselves as matter, practically speaking. So what is the mixture between these two? Let's hear what the verse says, and then we'll go on to the purport. The individual living entity, while inhabiting the material bodies he has created for himself by his calling, he's inhabiting them, actually remains uncovered by either gross or subtle matter. This is so because, as the Vedas describe, he is part and parcel of you, O Lord, the possessor of all potencies. Having determined this to be the status of the living entity, this meaning the aloofness, the unentangledness, being part of the spiritual energy, having determined this, learned sages become imbued. Imbued means filled with faith. Filled means they inculcate, they bring into their very essence faith and worship. And then, because they have faith, they worship your lotus feet, to which all Vedic sacrifices in this world are offered, and which are the source of liberation. So knowing something, they act, they imbibe something. Knowing something, what? That they are not actually contaminated by the material modes of material nature, even though we speak in that sense. But they are not ever contaminated, touched, or infiltrated by the atoms of, we are in colloidal suspension in the material energy. We don't mix with the material energy either on the subtle level or on the gross level. Knowing this, and knowing that they are eternally energy, separated particles of Krishna Shakti, of the Chaturagya Shakti, or the Jiva Tati, the Tasta Shakti. Knowing this, and that they're the potency of Krishna, the Tathasta Shakti of Krishna, their faith increases. And because of that, they worship Krishna's lotus feet. And those lotus feet are the source, the worshipping of the lotus feet become the source of liberation, or the freedom from the entanglement of, that the living entities have, despite their being unentangled. So we'll see what the verse, the purport, will say about what is the cause of this entanglement, and we all know the answer. It is Maya, the inconceivable, empowered Maya Shakti. It bridges the gap and causes the soul to think himself, being bewitched and enchanted by Maya, the spirit soul thinks himself a different energy. So let me read the verse again, because I spoke it, and you can all put together the, as I'll read it slowly, and you can speak internally to yourselves, add all the philosophy you can as I read it. The individual living entity, while inhabiting the material bodies he has created for himself by his karma, actually remains uncovered by either gross or subtle matter. This is so. What is so?
It's uncovered.
Because, as the Vedas describe, he is part and parcel of you, the possessor of all potencies. There is no potency independent of Krishna. Nothing exists outside of him. All rests in him. This is the absolute truth, the Lord and his potencies. So therefore, the fifth chapter of Adi Lila of Chaitanya Charitamrita is entitled, what? No, maybe it's not the fifth chapter. It's like not the fifth chapter, the one word. Chaitanya in five features, the Lord in five features. The absolute truth and his features of his different energies and expansions, including the Jiva Shakti, his expansion, and his avatars, and his Shaktis. So this is the composition of the Absolute Truth, the Lord and his energies. And the difference between, one difference between the Nimbarkas and the Gaudiyas is this, that we speak that the energy of the Lord is, what's it called, Shakti Parinam, is if there's transformations of the energies, and they say that causes transformation of the Lord, and we say, no, the Lord isn't transformed, it's just the energies that are transformed. That's the difference. So an understanding that we have a relationship with Krishna, hearing it, knowing it, having faith in it, they therefore worship the Lord, and therefore worship His feet, which are the source of liberation, which means His service automatically brings freedom from the material world, because there is no, because the soul is identifying with the Lord servant, being the Lord servant as opposed to His body. So purport. Not only does the Supreme Lord remain totally uncontaminated, which was the last verse, when He resides within the material bodies of the conditioned souls, but even the infinitesimal jiva souls are never directly touched by the coverings of ignorance and lust they acquire while passing through repeated cycles of birth and death. Thus the Taittiriya Upanishad proclaims, Sayas chayam purushe yas chasav aditye saika. The soul of the embodied living being is one with Him who stands within the sun. The soul of the embodied living being is one with Him who stands within the sun. Very esoteric truths. So that's the Lord. We stand with the Lord. He is the Lord. You are not different. Chandogya Upanishad, Tat Tamasi, you are that, means you are not different from that Supreme Truth. You are, so Mahaprabhu, of course, gives the philosophy, gives us the wonderful Veda Veda, Achintya Veda Veda Tattva philosophy, that we are non-different, but yet different in quantity. We are non-different in quality. We are composed of the spirits and energy. In this prayer, the personified Vedas refer to the finite enjoyer of material bodies, the jiva soul, as an expansion of the transcendental reservoir of all potencies, the Supreme Lord. The third amsa kritam, made as His portion, must be properly understood, however, in this context. The jiva is not created at any time, nor is He the same kind of expansion of the Lord as the omnipotent Vishnu Tattva expansions. The Supreme Soul is the proper object of all worship, and the subordinate jiva soul is meant to be His worshipper. The Supreme Lord enacts His pastimes by showing Himself in innumerable aspects of His personality, whereas the jiva is forced to change bodies whenever his accumulated karmic reactions so dictate. So that's the difference. According to Sri Narada Pansaratna, Yat tatastam tu chirupam swasam vedyam vinirgatam ranjitam gunaragena sajiva itti katyate. The marginal potency, who is spiritual by nature, who emanates from the self-cognizant sambit energy, and who becomes tainted by his attachment to the modes of material nature, is called the jiva. Although the jiva soul is also an expansion of Lord Krishna, he is distinguished from Krishna's independent Vishnu expansions by his constitutional position on the margin between spirit and matter. As the Mahavaraha Purana explains, we won't read the Sanskrit there, the Supreme Lord is known in two ways, in terms of His plenary expansions and His separated expansions. Between the plenary expansions and their source of expansion, there is never any essential difference in terms of either their capabilities, forms, or situation. The separated expansions, on the other hand, possess only minute potency, being endowed only to a small extent with the Lord's power. So, again, this isn't news to us, but what the point is that we're seeing very clearly that it is because we want to understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead as Krishna, and we want to give ourselves to Him, and we want to serve Him. And if we especially in the Vedic culture, so much of the impetus for action and surrender and service is the faith gained, Shastriya Shraddha, is faith gained from Shastra. So we hear Srimad Bhagavatam saying Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And then the question comes, what about the Shrutis? What about the Vedas? What about the Upanishads? They seem to imply something quite different from Krishna being the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And just as in the next chapter, we'll hear how Lord Shiva, and then in the next one, Mahavishnu, everyone is subordinate to this little coward boy. And the Vedas also say this. Because we need to gather our trust and faith to give ourselves fully. And to give ourselves fully, especially in this culture, this Vedic culture, the Shastra was so essential to guide and direct our faith, and people trusted Shastra. And it was Shastra that impelled them to act. It was Shastra that they could trust, because it is divine. It is coming from the mouths of the divine. It's coming from the Lord or the Lord's most exalted and perfected devotees. So they trusted it for guidance in this world. They didn't trust their minds. But today, I mean, not this particular day, the 30th of January 2010, but nowadays, people trust not Shastra, but trust their minds. And that is despite their minds having revealed to them by experience tens and tens of times in a day what to speak of in their life, that the mind is the most untrustworthy of things. But yet, this is the power of illusion. This is the power of Maya. We trust our minds explicitly, and we won't, you know, we trust. We are mind bhaktis. But in the Vedic culture, people were Shastra-oriented. So the Upanishads and the Vedas were very important. And also in our preaching, that we come across, even nowadays, it's all over the West too, because of the yoga. As they say, the yoga scene, that there are so many people who they don't accept it as the ultimate authority, but showing that because there's been so much advaitic preaching, non-dual preaching, and people identifying with the religion of India, they everyone in the West practically thought religion of India is advaita, means non-dualism, that we are all one, that everything is one, and everything, anything not appearing to be one with everything, is simply an illusion. This is what everyone's conception of the philosophy of India was until Prabhupada and his followers started their preaching only 40 some odd years ago. Close to 50, isn't it now? 66, 76, 86, 96. Yeah, well, it's over 40 years. So amazing things have been accomplished, if one thinks about it. Now, I actually was listening to some university lectures last year. There was some old professional professor was speaking, and he was talking about the different philosophies of India, and he said, in Krishna, the Bhagavad Gita, is a different philosophy than the Advaita one. These are two different philosophies. So when it hits academia, that means the students hear it. So it's, Prabhupada wanted this so much, and this so much of our preaching is that it's not all one. It's just that. There is, in India, there are two, there's the Advaita school, and then there's the Vaishnava school. It's not just the Advaita's goal. What did you think before? Hindu means?
Didn't think about it.
He who knows does not speak. He who speaks does not know.
That's fools.
It's also
one of those garbage.
Also, there's a lot of that in the 60s. I remember where it came from too. But in any case, other than all that, so this philosophy, it's to some degree it's meant for those coming from the Vedic culture. And also it's essential for us to know, and it's essential for us to know for ourselves and for our speaking to others as well. So the point being that he's covered, this jiva is covered but not surrounded. He's covered, surrounded by matter and trapped in illusion due to his desires and attachments. So how can the jiva get out then? That was what's mentioned in the part, little bit that we're skipping, that question. So now we'll read a little more of the purport. One's realizations of the splendor of the Lord's lotus feet, gradually nourished by the offering of Vedic sacrifices. Let me read that again. One's realization of the splendor of the Lord's lotus feet, some understanding of the Lord's glories, gradually nourished by the offering of Vedic sacrifices, increased by offering Vedic sacrifices, automatically bears the fruits of liberation from material existence and irrevocable faith in the Lord's mercy, because it's based on experience. We know it's true, it works. One can accomplish all this while still living in the material world. As Lord Krishna states in the Gopaltapani Upanishad, Matura Mandalayastu Jambudipesito Tava Yo Archayet Patimam Prati Same Priyataro Bhumi. One who worships me in my deity form while living in the district of Mathura, or indeed anywhere in Jambudri, becomes most dear to me in this world. And Srila Sridhar Swami concludes with his prayer. So in other words, the effect of the worship of the Lord is so apparent that because one becomes dear to the Lord, then the Lord becomes dear to him, because the soul is already dear to the Lord. And then Sridhar Swami concludes by praying, Twaram sasya mameshan twanmaya kita bandhanam Parangri seva madishya parananda navartaya. My Lord, please free me, your partial expansion, from the bondage created by your Maya. Please do this, O abode of supreme bliss, by directing me to the service of your feet. So each of these verses ends with a wonderful prayer by Srihat. Srila Swami imbibes the spirit of the verse. It directs it towards where it's meant, towards the lotus feet of the Lord. Okay, we'll stop here. We've finished 20 to some degree. To 30 is one section, and then 30. 40 is another, and then the final prayer of 42. So next week, we're almost finished. And then the beginning of the next week, we finish the chapter, and finish the final chapters. Thank you. Any questions or comments?
Do you have the summaries of each verse?
You have a post-it.
Like, short.
I would like to write it out, but I have it on my own post-it. I'll probably adjust them a little bit as I go along. But yes, I do.
Can I ask you to read again these four verses, these summaries? But especially the first day's verse, I didn't catch 16. The summary.
This is what I have. This is what I summarized it as. Let me just get my little paper. Hearing about you removes misery which comes from material contamination. Worshipping you awards bliss. Remember, there were two, I don't think I actually read that, but there were two sections of that verse. The glories of hearing were the two levels of persons. One who's not yet purified, it purifies, and the one who's purified, he can worship. And he becomes absorbed in the pastimes of the Lord and bliss. Then the next one.
This is 15.
That was 16.
16.
And 17. You alone are the underlying cause of all in existence, but you are distinct from both the subtle and gross manifestations. That's what I put down. 18. The process of yoga ultimately is meant to attain, to glorify and attain you. Attain and glorify you. And then 19. You are the super soul within the hearts of all living entities. You remain constant despite traveling with the living entities, the souls, as they change their bodies. You are that principle, constant principle of them. And then 20, being spiritual and your part and parcel, the living entities never truly are entangled in Maya. Therefore, one who knows this worships you with faith. That's what I had been. And through the Sri Goswami has converted the essence of these verses into prayers to the Lord by putting up this. There's the verse, and then therefore, O Lord, please accept me, and please, something relating to the verse, because you have these qualities. So he's brought the quality into a prayer, the characteristic that the Shrutis are describing and glorifying the Lord, he's changed it into a prayer to him. So quite wonderful. Any other questions? Yes.
Sometimes I doubt on the philosophies when I see various philosophies, so doubts arise in my mind. So how can I use those doubts to intensify my faith?
How could you use the doubts to intensify?
Those same doubts to intensify my faith in Krishna.
By bringing them up and asking the devotees, what about this? It says this, and this, this, and this, and I heard this. Could you please, out of your kindness, dispel my doubts? Because then my faith will increase, and then I will undoubtedly act upon my newfound increased faith. Put it into action immediately. Yes, what to do with doubts? Bring them up. Write them down. You have a book of doubts?
Make one.
You can get a little teeny notebook. A small, maybe this big. No, what I mean is questions. A book of questions. Don't just let them swirl around in your mind. Channel them into your pen. And then write them down onto the paper. And then ask the devotees. And the devotees, generally, they like to hear questions because that gives them a chance to speak about Krishna and increase their own realizations too. And if you're not satisfied with one devotee's answer, you thank you very much. And then you can also ask him until you're satisfied. If you're not satisfied, then you. Any other questions? Is that right? But it doesn't do any good to say, oh, I'm not supposed to doubt. Because that doesn't make them go away, at least from my experience. So write them down and ask. Yes?
Well, there's a strong thing here that regarding that,
Above sitting in the purport, it says that the yogis who leave their bodies through the Brahmarandra.
Let's go, get there.
It's on page 630. It's the end of the second paragraph.
Yes.
The yogis who leave their bodies through this chakra, the Brahmarandra, go directly to the kingdom of God, from which they need never return to be reborn. Thus even the unsure process of meditation and yoga can bear the fruit of pure devotion if it is followed perfectly.
Yes.
So,
yes. What question do you have on that?
Yeah, usually we understand that the yogis, they have a chance to become devotees, but here it says they go to the kingdom of God directly.
If they are devotees.
Yeah.
If that's their desire. That's why he says following it perfectly. What he means by perfectly is that if you desire to merge if you desire to go into Brahman, which some yogis may desire, that's an imperfect following. Imperfect meaning incomplete following of yoga. Because Kapila Muni's teachings, yoga is meant for meditation, and even in Patanjali's teachings, yoga, Pahi, surrender in Yoga Sutra.
Which one? What?
You know, yoga's purpose is controlling the senses, and then there's
Nirodha.
Yeah, and then that's quieting the mind. But where it says that yoga's pranidhana.
Ishvara pranidhana samadhi.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Ishvara pranidhana means surrender to the Ishvara. So in Kapila Muni, in the third canto, he teaches specifically how to meditate upon the Lord. So this will bring one to Shanta Bhakti, Shanta Ras.
Mm-hmm.
Meditation in and of itself can do that. Meditation of the Lord.
Yes, so that was my question, that how do they enter the kingdom of God in that
because
state?
Mm-hmm.
They go to Vaikuntha, or
yeah.
Is that?
Yeah, that's what it would say. They enter the kingdom of God, they go to Vaikuntha. Why? It's because their consciousness is completely full of the form of the Lord. So why wouldn't they go there? That's what they want. I mean, that's because Vishnu is smart and it's bhakti. We don't, as we mentioned before, we don't get Paramahansa Rupa. Even though he's called it in Bhakti Samhita Sindhu, the devotion, he's called it Bhakti Ras, but actually the Vaishnavas, including he himself, don't accept it as Bhakti Rasa, because there's no rasa in it, and because there's no seva in it. It's just meditation, just how wonderful he is. Mm-hmm. So if one's conscious, it's like when we look at Krishna Balaram and Radha Shyamasundara, sometimes all we do is meditate on, we're Santaras in the sense, we're just in awe of how wonderful their forms are. So that's what the yogis do. They're just so enamored, entranced by the beauty of his lotus feet and his smile and everything, that they don't want to withdraw their minds from his form for even a moment. So naturally, if they leave the world, their bodies and that consciousness, And because their consciousness is fully clear on that platform, there's nothing to disrupt it. They have no desires. They're fully satisfied doing that. So therefore, naturally, they go there.